Dateline, October 15th, New York Times. In internet shorthand, it began, yes, I-K, or I know. Yeah, I bullied Rebecca and she killed herself. The writer concluded that she didn't care, then used an obscenity to make the point. And so it was. 5 weeks ago, Rebecca Ann Sedgwick, a seventh grader in Lakeland, Florida, jumped to her death from an abandoned cement factory silo after enduring a year on and off of face-to-face and online bullying. That Facebook post, Sheriff Grady Judd of Polk County said, was so offensive that he decided to move forward with the arrest immediately rather than continue to gather evidence. With a probable cause affidavit in hand, he sent his deputies that night to arrest two girls, calling them, quote, primary harassers. The first, a 14-year-old girl, is the one who posted the comment. The second, her friend and Rebecca's former best friend, a 12-year-old, was also charged. They were charged with aggravated stalking, a third-degree felony, and will be processed in the juvenile court system. Neither had an arrest record. The older girl taken into custody is being held at the juvenile wing of the Polk County Jail, and the younger girl, who expressed some remorse, was released to her parents' custody. Mitch Horowitz, who I think is one of our most perceptive cultural critics, wrote that this tragic news must serve as one more than just another reminder for parents and teachers to monitor online chatter. The episode, he said, exemplifies how we as a culture, from children to adults in both the public and private realms, have grown coarser and cruder. In many respects, he said, our nation has ruptured with civility. It's not that human nature has changed. We've simply become more transparent. The advent of digital communication has allowed us to engage in consequence-free hostility. When facial reactions and emotional responses are placed at a remove from real people, hostile messaging, abrupt emails, and the caustic online posts and reviews, often done anonymously, have normalized an uglier and less empathetic side to human behavior. This has colored our politics, and it has made entertainment what it is today. I would like you to witness the humiliations routinely showcased on so-called reality TV, from Jerry Springer, even to such shows as Top Chef. And the snarls of call-in shows and the acidic tone of all those popular blogs. Horowitz wrote that, he said, we're not built to like everybody, but we are built to behave civilly. And we need to reinforce that message in our schools, in our homes, in sports programs, and within the world of digital commerce. Teenagers and adults need to be called out, he wrote, whenever there's excessive sarcasm, soft bullying, or anything that denigrates another individual. This is what I take from all this, that humiliation is not entertainment. Whether it's a shock jock or a coarse reality TV show or some awful tweet that a football player bullied another one into, an obnoxious song or some shout fest on political TV, I think we have an obligation to simply turn it off. That's about as preachy as I often get, but I'm pretty serious about this. And when I talk about the rupture of civility in our culture or families or even in this church, I'm not talking about some kind of genteel and sentimental understanding. This isn't inviting Mr. Darcy to tea, after all. What I'm talking about here is simply being polite enough to at the very least not bully another person with your truth, and at our very best to consider how others take our comments. Because too often we don't think about that. Civility is such an interesting word, and, you know, being a civic person is such an interesting concept that Honda named a car after it. But the word is deeply profound and very important, I think, for Unitarian Universalists. It comes from the Latin civitas. It means to live in community. That's what the word means. And that means knowing when to listen and when to speak and when to disagree without being disagreeable. And I believe it's also a spiritual practice, because I believe it's the foundation of our being able to learn from others and, perhaps paradoxically, to learn to respect ourselves. Because I want you to think for a moment about how a girl who's 14, who bullied another girl to commit suicide, feels about herself. Let me give you an example from my own life. 3 decades ago, when I was a much younger and angrier man, I had a small solar energy company. I had 3 employees. 2 of them were about my age, and the 3rd one, Bill Rosenhauer, was quite a bit older. Bill lived alone. He'd never married. His parents, I later learned, had survived the Nazi Holocaust and had left before that had become so terrible, and they moved to Minnesota, actually, where a lot of German immigrants moved, and they raised a family there. Just Bill, actually. And Bill was sometimes a forgetful and very hard worker. It was a frustrating time for me because I was trying to grow this little company, and I had to continually remind him to do something or to show up, and I got to tell you, I wasn't always kind. I'm not proud to say that. Frankly, I would berate him. I'm not proud to say that either. Now, one time Bill got sick and turned out to be a rather serious flu. And he called me to say he wasn't going to come into work that day. And we had a very big job, a lot of money on the line. And I was furious. I slammed down the phone. I got in the truck. I drove over there. I don't know what I thought I was going to do, what, pull him out of bed or something. And I'm pounding on the door. And I can hear him walking softly. You know, that ministers can do that now. We knock on a door and you can hear somebody coming. Or somebody who's just sitting there hoping you'll go away. And he unlocks the door. But before I could get off on my rant, he puts his hand up like this and he says, "Come in. Sit down. I need to talk to you." So I walked in and I sat down at a very modest little kitchen table, and he poured me weak coffee, which Midwesterners seem to prefer, and his gentleness and hospitality was beginning to disarm me. And he pulled out a picture of his mother and his father after they had arrived in the United States. He said, "You know, they had nothing when they came here. They made a life, they made me." He said, "I haven't told many people this, but I had to take care of them. They died young, both of them, within a couple of years of each other. I watched them slip away. And as a boy, I had contracted rheumatic fever, and I had lost some memory, and it was difficult for me to remember what to do or what pills to give them." And he said then, "I'm not as fast as the other fellas, but I am careful, and I do need this job." Well, obviously I was a bit chagrined. I sat back and sort of let this wash over me, ashamed of my anger, of my incivility. I had been rather hard-hearted in the last year or so of that very difficult time, and I could feel my heart open a bit. It would, of course, take me many more years, a failed marriage because of my anger and some other issues, a business that ended up failing after it all was done and said. It would take therapy and Francis, which is better than therapy, 5 kids and 3 congregations to learn what civility means. The point is this. The next time you want to tell someone off, the next time you really want to put somebody in their place, The next time you walk away instead of engaging, consider the civility you are giving up. We are unique creatures, my friends. We are unique creatures on this green earth that we can really understand what it means to be kind. And it takes a certain amount of humility, a certain amount of courage, and yes, a certain amount of gratitude. Now you may say, why gratitude? Well, gratitude because to be uncivil is to somehow be ungrateful. I told you that I was going to, every sermon this month, talk a little bit about dogs. Because I'm really into dogs this month. This is dog month for me. And I want to talk a little bit about something that I read from a commentator on one of those blogs, a very kind woman by the name of Carrie Newcomer. And this is what she said about her dog that taught her about civility. She said that when her ability to run and swim had left, and when she was just happy to walk, she walked, but slower. She did not grieve because she did not have to grieve. She loved what was directly in front of her, in the present. She did not miss worrying whether or not she had the best seat in the house. How many times do we worry about the best seat in the house? How many times have we equated with what we have to who we are? Carrie said that the life of a dog is in the now, to be grateful for the now, grateful for what is. It's very sound wisdom and actually awfully good theology. This is what Bill Rosenhauer taught me about civility. Maybe the gift was that I was supposed to slow down, not go so fast. Civility is possible for any of us. But as Mitch Horowitz put it, on the corporate level, that is really the corporate or the institutional level, those organizations that are really embracing civility have learned how to handle their online traffic. I've seen this with certain websites that no longer accept anonymous comments. That actually is starting to come to an end. And it's starting to actually extend to customer reviews. You actually have to sign in and leave your name. You can make it up, I suppose. But you have to own what you're saying. Because what he said is that nothing encourages hateful remarks more than being anonymous. Dislike is natural. Disdain is not. And when we are anonymous, it's really easy to be disdainful. And if we don't advise or devise another way to tone down our day-to-day life, the legacy we're going to pass on to the next generation is this coarsened, crippled manner of acting out in the world. I think about this a lot as Unitarian Universalists because one of our principles implores us to affirm and promote a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. It's part of our identity. Of all the principles, though, this one gives me pause and sometimes troubles me because I don't know whose truth it is we're supposed to be affirming here. Truth is, whether we like it or not, fairly relative. And I don't know many people who actually have the absolute truth. How often do we look for the truth that is in our own hearts? Psychologists now agree that the perception of what is true is often wired into us. Basically, not to get too dualistic about it, but which side of your head you want to use. You know, if you're more right-brained, you're going to see the world as a little more full. And if you're left-brained, you tend to be a little more anxious. I always like what Milton said, echoing the Roman philosopher Marcus Aurelius. The mind is in its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell and a hell of heaven. As a religious nation, my friends, and I think about this since we've just passed an election day, we are bound together by what my beloved and now departed colleague Forrest Church once called the American Creed. I love that. I love that idea that there is a civility that's at the heart of who we really are as a people and a nation and should be as a church. It's really our religion. A lot of people don't understand this, that the first 2.5 presidents were Unitarians. America is faithful, not just of the same faith. Tuesday night, I had the opportunity to strike up a conversation with one of the poll workers. For all I know, he's sitting out here now, and apologies. And we talked about that. We open our place up for elections. It's what we do. That's what we do now. And you always get some really interesting conversations from people who are new to Unitarian Universalism. They're looking here and they're going, what kind of place is this, really? I'm like, wow, what is that? What's that? And they're looking for some religious sign. And you know, we don't really have that. And he's packing up his car with the stuff and I'm leaving. And he said, what does your church believe? It's always a tricky question. So I talked about the search for truth and meaning. I talked about it being more of a process than a product. It's not like we can give you a little cheat sheet. I mean, we can, but you know, when you read our principles and they sound like the United States Constitution. Well, there's a reason for that, because a lot of the Constitution was written by Unitarians. So there you have it. But he says, well, you know, I believe that Jesus Christ died for our sins, but I would guess that you probably don't. I said, nope, not so much. And he said, well, I don't know what to make of that. And I said, well, you don't have to make anything of it. That's your truth, and this is our truth, and we think it's more than that. And then he said, well, I want to thank you for opening up your place. And I said, well, we're just doing our civic duty. That's the word I use, just doing our civic duty. And he said, and so am I. And something about that exchange sort of evened the field and made us the same. It was civility in practice, even though our theologies were vastly different. This creed in American history is based on the rights to the basic necessities. And last night, those of us who were here watched this film about hunger in America and about the paradoxical connection between not having enough good food and obesity, and how Americans assume that because poor people are obese, they must be abusing the food stamp system. The reality is that's not true at all. The reality is that $2.40 a day for a family of three, you're not buying fresh fruits and vegetables, my friends. You're buying processed Kraft macaroni and cheese. That's what you're buying, because that's what you can afford. And guess what happens? You get fat. That's what happens. It's the wrong food. And we have these rights that we try to embrace, and yet we seem to not quite get it sometimes. And yet, we still embrace them as ideals, and that embracing the ideal, embracing the principle, is an example of civility. You know, I hear a lot about, from the religious right, about how this country was founded on Christian values. Sort of. Not quite. Kind of. But it's not a Christian country. That's the difference. Our values are informed by Christianity. We are a majority Christian nation. But we're not all Christians. America is, I think, rather bound by a kind of a natural law, perhaps even, as Martin Luther King would say, a higher law. And what is that law? It's short, it's the belief that in order to be faithful to our belief in the goodness of all, this extension of compassion, this pursuit of happiness, we have to have the civility and freedom to follow that faith. Because a coerced faith is no faith at all. So this is the heart of who we are, bound together with our own beliefs under what they call one God, but you could call one spirit, e pluribus unum, not because there's one true faith, but because there's a freedom to have faith. And that freedom requires civility in order to be exercised. That's the point. I think that it's fair to say that these are dark days for the virtue of civility. Drivers on the freeway are aggressive, contemptuous. Reality television celebrates and exploits backstabbing chatter. Politicians berate one another with sort of gleeful abandon, and then they shake hands like it all didn't matter. I think that Alan Moranis puts this best when he reaches back to a millennium-old Jewish tradition called Musar. And Musar states that civility is not just about being considerate and respectful, but rather it's about seeing the spiritual impact of your behavior on another person in the eyes of God in the Jewish tradition. And when we grasp that deeper importance of the issue, perhaps we'll be able to be motivated to change. When it comes to governing a country, the great philosopher Maimonides explained, anger and envy are simply no help. Compassion and kindness are. Amy Zucker Morgenstern, my colleague in Palo Alto, said that too often we mistake disagreement for being disagreeable. I think that's a great line. Disagreement is welcome, disagreeableness is not. And my guidelines, she said, in deciding what comments to approve are good manners and common sense. Why is that so hard? To simply be kind. And while I value, she said, tangents as a hallmark of creative conversation, persistently using the comments section as a grindstone for your particular acts will do more than just irritate your host. It creates a culture of coarseness. And the digital age has only enhanced our ability to be disagreeable behind a digital wall of secrecy. I almost always discount anonymous complaints. I know that some of you don't agree with me about that. I think they sometimes are rude, and they're often untrue, but I think that they deny this impulse for us to face each other and say what we mean. And the next time we want to send a flamer off or two to somebody who just doesn't happen to agree with us, a coworker, a friend, even a member of this church, I'd like you to remember that you'll have to see them again. I tell myself this all the time before I push the send button on any email. I'll probably see them again, or I'll move, one of the two. So why is civility then so vital to life and spiritual growth? Because my people, without the very faith and freedom that comes from being civil, we simply couldn't be who we are, both as Unitarian Universalists and as Americans. And what makes a nation like this great is that it is spiritually possible to couple the freedom of expression with a call to serve. And civility invites us to service like that poll worker did here, like we did when we opened our doors. True service, the very civility that makes this a great country, what makes it run from day to day, is the result of freedom accorded to those who serve. And without it, this beautiful country and this church simply falls down. I want you, please, to remember that when you go out for lunch and maybe you don't like gumbo. Just be nice. I love gumbo. Thank you very much for the gumbo. You know, this is the heart of what we do. People ask me what I believe, like that friend there that I met in the parking lot. And I say, we believe in the freedom to search for that truth. Well, that's no freedom at all. That's no belief at all, they say. And I say, well, I'd like you to look again, because the very process of democracy keeps us true to a certain moral pathway. And at the very least, even if our ideas don't make sense to other people, let's try at least to be nice about it. And let's listen to other people, even though we may not agree with them. I think as long as there's a spark of life with us, as Jefferson once said, there will be a spirit calling on us to choose with kindness and civility. And I'm grateful for that. Amen. We will now receive this morning's offering, which